Chapter 3. Vince. Concerning matters which cannot be reduced to a pithy, italicized phrase of antiquarian explication. At first, Charisse thought it was the flu. Skylar was complaining of stomach pains, headaches, and nausea, so Charisse put her to bed. That night, Skylar's symptoms worsened. Her stomach started hurting so badly that she doubled over, clutching it. When Charisse tried to take her to the bathroom, she discovered that Skylar was hurting too much to even walk. She wiped the dirty blonde hair out of Skylar's face, dabbed at the tears with the Kleenex, and drove her to the hospital. That was when she called me at the Long Beach Grand Prix after party. I drove to the West Hills Medical Center with more speed and adrenaline than I had used in the race and joined Charisse, who was crying on her mother's shoulder in the hospital emergency room. The last hour had been a nightmare, they said. The doctors had assumed that Skylar's appendix had exploded, but when they anesthetized her and began the procedure for an appendectomy, they found her appendix healthy and intact. Instead, they saw that a cancerous tumor around her abdomen had exploded, spreading cancer all through her body. The tumor, they said, was the size of a softball. I couldn't understand how such a large tumor had appeared in Skylar. I always associated cancer and tumors with old people. Not my 4-year-old. After another hour, they let Charisse and me into the intensive care unit to see Skylar. When I saw her attached to all these tubes and machines, for once in my life, I didn't know what to do. This was my daughter, hooked up to a life support system. When I had seen her just a weekend ago, she'd been running circles around my legs trying to make me dizzy. Charisse and I sat side by side without a word for the first time in 2 years, waiting for Skylar to stir. After an hour, she rolled around, mumbled something about Cinderella, and fell back asleep. Charisse and I looked at each other and wanted to cry with relief. The next day, Skylar was almost fully conscious and lucid, and she was as scared as I had been the night before when I saw the tubes and machines. She asked where she was and why she was there and what all this stuff was. We explained as gently as we could that she had something growing in her stomach, like a flower, but it wasn't supposed to be there, so the doctors took it out. She smiled weakly and said she wanted to go home. I asked the doctors when I could take Skylar home, and they said that she needed to be transferred to the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles first to make sure that they had removed all the fragments of the tumor. I'd heard of the hospital because it was run by the T.J. Martell Foundation, which helps children with leukemia, cancer, and AIDS. Since Motley Crue had done a lot of charity work for the T.J. Martell Foundation over the years, like playing against Fleetwood Mac in their first Rock and Jock softball game benefit, we won. I called Tony Martell in tears, and he made sure Skylar received the best care possible. I rode to the Children's Hospital in an ambulance with Skylar, and the moment we arrived, they ran a CAT scan on her. The thought of her being blitzed with radiation at such a young age sickened me, but I had no choice. Heidi had returned from Florida, so she waited with Charisse and me for the results. We sat there, awkward, uncomfortable, and chewing our fingernails to the skin. When the doctor returned, whatever jealousy and ill will remained among the three of us was banished forever by the news. There were tumors, the doctor said, on both of Skylar's kidneys. They would have to operate again to remove them. When we told Skylar, she buried her face in Charisse's chest and asked again when she could go home. Soon, we told her, very soon. Music studios, strip clubs, concert halls, and any semblance of my past life disappeared as the hospital became the center of my existence. Even the divorce that Charisse and I had been wrestling over for 2 years was put on hold. Every day, Charisse, myself, our parents, or Heidi sat with Skylar in her room, praying that we could take her home soon. We kept saying, just one more operation, just one more treatment, just one more day, and it would all be over. But every day, the news got worse and worse. When the doctors brought Skylar into the operating room to remove the tumors on her kidneys, They pulled back the flaps of her skin and were horrified by what they saw. The tumors were so large that simply removing them would have been fatal. They sewed her up yet again and told us she would have to undergo more radiation treatment. This way, they said, the tumors would shrink to a size at which they could be safely removed. Gradually, I began drinking again to cope with the pain. I would stay at the children's hospital as long as they'd let me. Then I'd drive straight to Moonshadows in Malibu and get liquored up with the regulars until I couldn't remember my own name. The next morning, I'd wake up, drive to the hospital, stay all day or maybe even sleep over, and then get blitzed at Moonshadows. I knew it was wrong to be drinking at this time, but it was the only way I could keep from going completely crazy. My entire being was reduced to just three emotions: anxiety, depression, and anger. I was angry all the time. When some guy in a blue BMW cut me off on the Pacific Coast Highway, I slammed on the brakes and yelled, "Fuck you!" The guy stepped out of his car, I stepped out of mine. Heidi, who was in the passenger seat, yelled in horror, "What's wrong with you?" I stepped back into my car, spat on the windshield in anger, and was preparing to peel out when the guy threw himself over my hood and refused to move. "That's fucking it," I yelled at Heidi. I stormed out of the car, slammed the door so hard the mirror fell off, pulled him off the hood by his shirt collar, and punched him in the face in front of a crowd of gawkers. I punched him so hard that my knuckles split open to the bone. The guy dropped to the ground with blood streaming out of his face as if it had been split with an axe. Passersby had to call an ambulance to scrape him off the ground. I left before the cops arrived and gunned it to the hospital. I wasn't going to waste any more time in this piece of shit. As soon as I walked in, the doctors looked at the anger still seething on my face and then down at the blood coagulating on my hand and didn't have to ask what had happened. They brought me into the x-ray room and informed me that I'd broken my hand. They bandaged it and said there would be no charge. They knew what I was going through because they had seen it so many times before, though perhaps not to this exact degree of self-destructiveness. More and more, I fell asleep at Skylar's bedside, crying and confused, frustrated that this cancer beyond my control was growing and consuming my daughter, my life, and our future together. Every time I returned to the hospital, Skylar was in more pain and confusion. We would watch Married with Children in the hospital. Just a month ago, she used to drop whatever she was doing and dance around the house to the theme song, Frank Sinatra's Love and Marriage. But now she just stared listlessly at the television, knocked out on morphine. If we were lucky, a smile would crack open across her face and send our hearts racing with happiness. With the tumor on Skylar's right kidney starting to press against her lungs, it was a losing battle trying to preserve that smile. I brought Skylar her favorite toys and the clothes she liked to dance in. We watched Disney videos and sang children's songs together. Since I was now signed to Warner Brothers Records, I used my connections to bring entertainers in Bugs Bunny and Sylvester costumes to the hospital with big gift baskets for Skylar and the other children in the ward. On Easter, Heidi and I went to Save-On and bought bags full of candy and Easter egg painting kits. Then I did something I never would have done for Motley Crue, no matter how much they pleaded. I stripped out of my clothes and put on a giant fuzzy Easter bunny outfit. Skylar didn't even recognize me until I started talking. Then she burst out laughing. I cried, and as the tears mingled with sweat under the outfit, I turned around and said, "Charisse, hand me those eggs." "What did you just call me?" came the curt, sharp, and angry voice of Heidi. Charisse wasn't even in the hospital. And if there's anything a girlfriend doesn't forgive, it's calling her by an ex's name, even if it occurs at the sickbed of a child. For the next few minutes, Easter turned into Halloween as we put on a very different kind of show for the kids. For a relatively young girl in a new relationship, Heidi was under a lot of pressure she had never bargained for between the fact that I was still technically married and that all our dates were taking place in the presence of nurses and Charisse instead of waiters and friends. At first, everyone just saw her as a blonde bimbo. But after months of Heidi hiring entertainers such as a Snow White impersonator, sitting at Skylar's bedside, holding her hand every day, and being very careful not to compete or interfere with Charisse, The doctors and Charisse's family eventually accepted her, though never quite enough to treat her like part of the family. "Daddy?" Skylar asked when she woke up one morning. "I'm never going home, am I?" "Of course you're going home," I said. And I wasn't lying. The doctors had told me that we could take Skylar home and simply bring her in for chemotherapy. After a month straight in a hospital cot, Skylar finally returned to her own bedroom. Unfortunately, she didn't get to enjoy it for long. Every night she would sleep less and cry more, saying that her stomach hurt. When she went to the bathroom, she'd scream with a pain that sounded more wrenching than anything I'd experienced in a life 8 times as long as hers. We brought Skylar back to the hospital after only 4 nights at home. The doctor said that scar tissue from her last surgery had formed on her intestines, twisting them and obstructing her bowels. When Charisse told our daughter that she was going to have to endure another operation, Skylar said in the weakest, saddest, most innocent voice I'd ever heard, "Mommy, I don't want to die." She knew that what was happening to her was not normal, that all the smiles and jokes coming from Charisse and me were forced, that the relatives and friends who visited never used to cry when they saw her. "The nice doctors are going to help you go to sleep for a little bit while they do another operation," Charisse said, dabbing the sweat off Skylar's forehead. "And when you wake up, Mommy and Daddy will be right here waiting for you. We love you, honey, and everything is going to be okay. We'll all be home again soon." I needed to believe that what Charisse was saying was true as badly as Skylar did. After the operation, Skylar looked even worse than before. I noticed for the first time how all the life had drained out of her face, how forced and short her breathing had become, how every ounce of baby fat had been replaced by bones pressing against skin. "Daddy," she begged, "please don't let them cut me again." I didn't know what to say. The doctors had already told me that her right kidney would have to be removed. 3 days later, she was in the operating room again. And when the doctors wheeled her back, it wasn't like the TV shows. They never said, "Congratulations, the operation was a success." They said, "I'm sorry, Vince, but something unexpected happened. The cancer has spread to her liver, intestines, and dorsal muscles." "Did you remove the kidney?" "No, we couldn't even remove the tumor. It isn't responding well to chemo. It is bonded so tightly to her kidney that to remove it would cause fatal blood loss. That, however, does not mean that there is no hope. There are other options available to us, and God willing, one of them will get rid of this thing for good." But this thing kept growing, consuming the girl I loved too much too late. On June 3rd, I received a call from the oncologist in charge of Skylar's doctors. When you're at the hospital every day, the last thing you want to do is pick up the phone at home and hear a doctor's voice, because it can only mean one thing. "Skylar had stopped breathing," the oncologist told me. The doctors had just placed her on a respirator and injected her with a medication that, in effect, paralyzed her so that she wouldn't expend excess energy. She couldn't laugh, she couldn't move, she couldn't speak. In 4 months, she had gone from a happy little 4-year-old to a sad, wired-up mannequin. She never even had a chance to live, and now she was in a worse condition than most people in nursing homes. For all practical purposes, she was death with a heartbeat, though I tried to convince myself that it was just a temporary sleep. She was a strong girl, though, and her body continued to fight the cancer. Her signs stabilized, her heart rate increased, and every now and then her lungs would pump a little air on their own. After a month and a half of this limbo state, the doctors decided that they had no choice. It was better to attempt to remove the tumor than just leave her hovering in and out of life. The operation was extremely dangerous, but if Skylar made it through, they said it was very likely that she would recover. Charisse's family, my family, Charisse, and my son Neil joined Heidi and me in the hospital, and we all sat nervously together, taking turns running out for food while waiting for a word from the doctors operating on her. We fidgeted the whole time, unable to utter a sentence without bursting into tears. I thought about how cancer ran in my mother's side of the family and wondered if this was my fault. Or maybe I shouldn't have let the doctors treat Skylar with chemotherapy in the first place. I should have told them to remove the kidney. I should have brought Skylar to the hospital when she complained of a stomach ache half a year ago. Various thoughts ran through my mind, all containing those poisonous and impotent two words, should have. Finally, after 8 hours of anxiety, the doctors came out to say that Skylar was back in her room. They had successfully removed the tumor. It weighed 6.5 pounds. That's how much Skylar had weighed when she was born. I couldn't even conceive of something that immense growing inside her. I wanted to see what was killing my daughter, so I asked the doctors if they had kept the tumor. They brought me down to the pathology lab, showed it to me, and my stomach turned. I'd never seen anything like it before. It was the face of evil. It lay spread out in a metal pan, a nacreous mess of shit. It looked like a gelatinous football that had been rolled through the depths of hell, collecting vomit, bile, and every other dropping of the dam that lay in its path. It was, in every conceivable way, the exact opposite of the daughter Charisse and I had raised. In the process of removing the cancer, the doctors also had to take out Skylar's right kidney, half her liver, some of her diaphragm, and a muscle in her back. How many more organs could a girl lose and still be alive? But she was breathing and the cancer was gone. Every day she recovered a little more until she could speak and smile. Every gesture she made, a blink, a yawn, the word daddy, felt like a gift. I thought that everything would be okay now, that the nightmare was over, that Skylar could be a child again. I stopped drinking at Moonshadows and began cleaning up the house and my life for Skylar's return. 6 days after the operation, I was walking into the hospital with a giant stuffed panda when I was greeted by the doctors. They had that look. The look that says everything and nothing at all. The look of bad news that must inevitably and regrettably be delivered. I braced myself and knew before a word was spoken that I'd be back at Moonshadows that night. "Vince," the oncologist said, "it seems like an infection may be developing around Skylar's left kidney." "That's all she's got left. What does this mean?" "I'm afraid it means we're going to have to operate again and clean up around the kidney." "Jesus, you've already operated on my baby 5 times. How much more can she take?" It turned out that she couldn't take much more. After the operation, she went into a fast decline. Her lungs, her left kidney, and her liver all began a mutiny, refusing to function properly. Mercifully, she soon slipped into a coma. Her little body just couldn't take any more. It had been cut open and sewn back up so many times. It had been pumped so full of drugs. It had been shot through with more radiation than anyone should be exposed to. It had endured the slicing, dicing, rearranging, scraping, and removal of so many of its contents that, like a brake that had been pressed over and over, the parts had worn away and no longer knew how to work together. When your body starts to fall apart, there's no one who can fix the machine. They can only keep it running for a little while longer. And sometimes I wonder whether I did the right thing by keeping Skylar running for so long, keeping her in such pain for 5 months, 1/10 of her entire life. I began to drink so heavily that I wouldn't last more than an hour at Moonshadows without passing out or vomiting all over Kelsey Grammer. I cut the most pathetic figure. A father who just couldn't deal with the pain of knowing that soon he would have to undergo the worst tragedy that a parent can bear, having to bury his own daughter. I'd given Skylar everything I had to give, even my own blood for transfusions. I would have been willing to lay down my own life if it would have helped. I'd never thought anything like that before. Not about my wife, not about my parents, not about anybody. Perhaps that was why I was trying to kill myself with the drink, so that somehow I could martyr myself and exchange my suffering for hers. Every morning I would sit at her bedside hungover and read her stories and tell her jokes and pretend to be brave, like everything could still possibly be okay. It shouldn't have come as a surprise when the oncologist told me to start bringing in her relatives and friends to say their goodbyes. But that was the first time I'd heard the doctor say that there was no hope. Before, there was always a small chance, or a good chance, or a tiny chance, or a fair chance, but never no chance. Perhaps I had reassured Skylar so many times that she would return home one day, and we'd build sandcastles on the beach again that I began to believe it myself. I walked into Skylar's room with Heidi afterward and saw drops of blood on her lip. Heidi was outraged that the nurses would just leave her lying there in that condition. She took a tissue out of her purse and bent down to wipe it. But the blood just stayed there on Skylar's lip. It had coagulated. Heidi kept wiping it and crying, "You fix it, you fix it." We both broke down on the spot. We stayed with Skylar until late at night when we left to get some food at Moonshadows. In the meantime, Charisse and her parents arrived to sit with Skylar. As soon as we settled down at a table, the bartender said I had a phone call. "Vince, get to the hospital now," came Charisse's trembling voice on the other end. Her vital signs are dropping fast. I didn't panic, I didn't cry, I just hurried. But I was too late. By the time I arrived at the hospital, Skylar had passed away. And I never had a chance to say goodbye and tell her one more time how much I loved her. Charisse said that Skylar had passed away peacefully. When her heartbeat started slowing, her eyes had opened with a momentary flash of fear and met her mother's in search of an answer or explanation. "Don't be scared, sweetie," Charisse had reassured her, squeezing her hand. "Go to sleep now. It's all right." And so Skylar slept. In the meantime, I sat in traffic on the Pacific Coast Highway, and for an instant, my heart jumped in my chest. But I was in such a hurry to be by Skylar's bedside that I ignored it and didn't think about it. But afterward, I realized that when the woman that I loved most in this world left, my heart knew it, and for a moment, wanted to catch up with her and join her. I left the hospital, drove straight to Moonshadows, borrowed a couple of painkillers from the Joe Isuzu actor David Leisure, and drank. Without the hospital, the bar became the entire focus of my existence. I put myself in a fog the night Skylar died, and with booze and pills, kept myself there so that I wouldn't have to think about it. I was her father, and I was supposed to protect her. I had done everything in my power for Skylar, everything, and the truth was that I was powerless. She was gone, I was here, and there was no changing that. The only thing that could be changed was for me not to be here, but I didn't have the balls to kill myself. I hoped that the booze and the pills would do the trick. I would take 20 10-milligram doses of Valium a day and drink hundreds of dollars in beer and whiskey. I didn't fucking care what happened to me. Sometimes I would imagine getting run down by a car, or decapitated by a madman, or just throwing myself through a window. I wanted to be with her so badly. Heidi and a diamond merchant I had met through Tommy and Heather, Bob Prokop, who was staying at my house after his was destroyed in an earthquake, arranged the funeral and took care of me like an invalid. I was incapable of showering, changing clothes, or doing anything for myself. I'd never had a relative that was close to me die before. I'd never even been to a funeral before. Now here I was, burying my own daughter. This wasn't how things were supposed to work. Skylar's grandparents had arranged a closed casket service for her, but someone screwed up and the casket was open. Inside was someone who didn't even look like my daughter. Her eyes were so swollen that I could see the root of her eyelash. I didn't want that to be my last image of her, so throughout the service, I stared at my feet. I couldn't bring myself to look at her pink casket. It was so little. She was so little. After the service, I was basically kidnapped, put in a limousine, And the next thing I knew, I was in a rehab clinic called Anacapa in Oxnard. Heidi had called in our one-man personal crisis hotline, Bob Timmons. I escaped that day, returned home to Malibu, swallowed a cocktail of pills from the medicine cabinet, and passed out. When I awoke, I was in another bed. I had somehow left home and checked into the Universal City Sheraton Hotel, where I continued to anesthetize myself. But whatever I did was never enough. Every night I woke up screaming from terrible nightmares. I'd imagine demons and devils dancing on Skylar's grave. Skylar's headstone had been ordered, but it hadn't been made yet. So I kept having the worst visions about it not being there and there being nothing to mark her grave. In other nightmares, I'd see her tumor growing to the size of a human being and attacking me, enveloping me in its cancer. And as the tumor smothered me, it would give off a strong odor. Not the smell of putrefaction or death, but the sweet, warm smell of Skylar. I'd taken the blanket she died in from the hospital, and every night I slept under it because the smell made me think of her as still living in this world. I spent at least a week in that nightmare state, unsure when I was conscious and when I wasn't, until Heidi and Bob Timmons finally talked me into checking into the Betty Ford Center. But before I went, I told them I was playing golf first. I somehow thought that would rehabilitate me. I flew to Palm Desert a couple hundred miles away and booked a room at the Marriott. For a week, I drank alone, played golf alone, passed out alone. Then, I locked my clubs and my clothes in my room and took a taxi to the Betty Ford Center. After 3 days of rehab, I was ready to really lose my mind. I couldn't deal with the therapist, the discipline, the guilt they kept heaping on me. I walked into the front office and said, "I'm out of here." They wanted their full $15,000 fee. I wrote a check and called a cab to the Marriott. Fuck them. I drank, golfed, and passed out for what was probably another month. I was lost to the world. I put myself in limbo. It looked like heaven, and I felt like hell. One day I shot a 76 and became so excited that I scared myself. I wasn't supposed to be this happy. Skylar was gone. What was I doing? I was running. I was hiding. I was playing golf at a resort. I called Heidi and Bob Timmons again, and this time they flew me to L.A. to check back into Anacapa in Oxnard. The treatment, they said, wasn't so much for alcohol or pills or golf as it was for grief. I needed to find a way to work through my emotions, to treat them with something besides a bottle and a 5-iron. I wrote Skylar a note, and then I set it on fire and burned it, watching the smoke ascend into the sky. That, for me, was the beginning of accepting a past I could not change. I began to think about Skylar's life in a different light, and to thank God for the 4 years that he gave her and allowed me to spend with her. I pledged to commit a greater percentage of my remaining life to charity work, to help other children and parents who were suffering, and to make sure that Skylar's death had not been in vain. When I called my parents and Heidi, they could tell simply by hearing my voice, which shook and sobbed less, that I'd come out the other end, that I could visit her grave now and decorate it with confetti and flowers on her birthday, and that I could finally smile when I remembered the funny things she used to do. I hadn't thought about Motley Crue in so long, and clearly they hadn't thought about me. Sure, we were at war, but as far as I was concerned, all our little hissy fits seemed so stupid and petty after what I'd been through. Not once, however, did those guys, who had been closer to me than my own sister, ever call. Maybe they just didn't know how to call or what to say. They would have to say something soon, because the week I was being released from rehab also happened to be the week we were supposed to meet for the first time in 4.5 years, in court. In all the drama of the past half year, I had forgotten that I'd sued them. While I was in rehab, Charisse and I finalized our divorce, and Heidi, who was closer to me than we ever expected to get after all this, moved into my place in Malibu. It was hard for Charisse and me to talk afterward. Skylar's illness had created a strong bond between us, but once she passed away, that bond snapped completely. Recently, however, the bond renewed itself. I kept asking the doctors how Skylar had gotten cancer. and they tell me that certain foods and chemicals and exposure to the sun and this and that all can cause cancer. But she's 4, I tell them. She's 4. What the fuck does a 4-year-old do to get cancer like that? She doesn't eat a lot of sugar. She uses sunscreen. She's a normal, average kid. I never found an answer. I just accepted the situation. But one day I was watching a news program about government rocket testing and chemical dumping in an area just north of Malibu called Simi Valley. That was where Charisse and I had lived. One of the reasons we had bought a house there was because it was on top of a hill and the area surrounding it, the real estate agent told me, was government-owned. So it would never be developed, which was great because I didn't want to look down on some ugly construction zone or plot of prefab houses. We like seeing a beautiful field and valley and wide open space outside every morning. We had no idea that a company called Rocketdyne Propulsion and Power was dismantling old nuclear reactors and dumping the waste there, and that a disproportionate number of residents of the area were dying from a variety of different types of cancer, including our Skylar. It was in the air, it was in the water, it was in our homes. More than 200,000 people filed a class action suit against Rocketdyne, and Charisse and I hired an attorney to prepare a lawsuit of our own. Of course, that won't bring Skylar back. It won't even make us feel any better. But maybe it will influence corporations to act more responsibly and prevent someone else from going through what we did. I often imagine that Skylar is still with me, sitting next to me in the car or lying in a warm lump next to me on the bed. I guess that makes me crazy, but it also keeps me sane.